Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. We are hitting limits to growth, and that is a fact that is becoming ever less disputable with every passing day. And of course, recognition of this is being fought tooth and nail by those who wish to preserve the status quo, or at the very least, their belief in it. One often overlooked area concerns mining and the physical resources that we demand from the natural world. Here to talk with us about this today is Professor Ugo Bardi, who teaches physical chemistry at the University of Florence in Italy. And he is interested in resource depletion, system dynamics modeling, climate science, with a special view on fossil fuel depletion and on the development of renewable energy. He's a member of the scientific committee of ASPO, which is the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas. His blog in English is CassandraLegacy.blogspot.com, and he has a new book out that we're going to talk about today. It's called Extracted: How the Quest for Mineral Wealth is Plundering the Planet. Now, that's our topic today. Welcome, Professor Bardi. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for me, too.
Great. So there's so much to talk about with you. I hardly know where to begin. So let's set the stage for our listeners. Your latest book, Extracted, what's it about and who's it trying to reach?
Well, that's a good point. I think the target of this book is the same as it was long ago for the Limits to Growth. Mm-hmm. We're trying to raise, in a certain way, the consciousness of people about this problem that we have. And it is very difficult because it has to do with the way our society take decisions. I mean, why do we do? What do we decide to do a certain kind of things? And very often, I think decision makers base their decision on faulty data, faulty theories, and half-baked models. That's a big problem, because I could make an example. When the latest events in Ukraine, you see that there have been seriously maintained that the United States could replace Russia in providing natural gas to Europe.
Right.
Now, if you just give a look to the data, that's not possible. It makes no sense. It would take decades at least. And even assuming that the present trends continue and the American market doesn't increase its consumption, still now the United States is an importer of natural gas. So the idea that somehow the U.S. can make the enormous investments needed to build the infrastructure that would be needed to liquefy gas, bring it to Europe, and then eventually replace the Russian pipelines, which bring gas here. So you see, I have this feeling, if we were to ask to the politicians, like to Mr. Obama or Mrs. Merkel, if they believe in what they are saying, I would think that they do believe it. I mean, they are not. They read newspapers and they make their mental models on the basis of what you read in the newspapers, and that's I think is a very dangerous thing to do. Because if you look at the data, for instance, the production of natural gas in 2013 in the United States increased just of 0.9% with respect to 2012, indication that we are already facing a big limits in what we can do in terms of increasing production. You see, this is an example. It's not. It is not in itself the whole story of minerals, of what we're doing, what we're trying to do, and how we can manage such a huge, gigantic, and little known subject. And that's a big problem we have, I think. It's not so much that we don't know about minerals, but we have troubles in assimilating this knowledge into decision making.
Well, indeed we do. And to build on your example, there's two main points that come out of the natural gas example. The first is, can you increase your production of it? Certainly, we always want to increase our consumption of these things, but production has to precede consumption. And the second is that However much there is, eventually someday it runs out, and both those things happen, right? So let's talk then about this idea that we have decision makers, we have people, not just politicians, but I think ensconced in companies, on Wall Street, in living rooms all across the world, who think that we can always just continue to increase our production of various things. Your book, Extracted, begins to talk through the issues around mining and of various things, copper, tin, bauxite, aluminum, you name it. And it's actually a far more complex subject than most people would realize. But the big trends that you're noting in your book are that we seem to be having to go to ever greater lengths to chase minerals in order to bring them to market.
That's the point. The whole point is that. So when people, you see, I have always this difficulty when people ask me, okay, but are we running out of this or that? Are we running out of rare earths? Are we running out of oil? Are we running out of natural gas? And it is very difficult to give a simple answer to a question which is not the right one. Because if I say, no, we are not going to run out of anything, then people just switch off their attention and say, okay, so if you're not going to run out of anything, or say, thank you very much, bye-bye, professor. Okay. But really, the question is ill-posed. The question is not when we run out of something. The question is, up to when are we able to afford a certain mineral commodity? Because it's a very well-known story, and it goes back to 19th century to the work of William Stanley Jevons, that the cost of extraction increases over time, simply because you pick the low-hanging fruit, so to say. In this case, you pick a fruit which is below ground, not from a branch, but it's the same concept. You have to go deeper and deeper to get the more difficult minerals as you run out of the easy, the least expensive mineral that you can extract. So this is the problem. And it's at some point you don't run out of anything. You run out of your financial capability of buying or paying for this task of extraction. So I try to frame this question. It's not a question of running out. It's a question of diminishing economic returns. A concept also goes back to Jevons back in mid-19th century. It's a very simple concept, diminishing economic returns from extraction. So you make less and less money, and in order to keep your profit, the company which extracts has to raise prices, and at some point customers will say, well, we cannot afford that anymore. At that point, it's like it's you start running out in the sense that you cannot have it anymore. It is still there, a little mineral is still underground, but you cannot afford to extract it. And that's the problem. And that's widely dispersed over all the metal commodities, mineral commodities, fossil fuels, rock, and whatever you have. It's the same problem everywhere, because we have been mining for tens of thousands of years, but in the past century, or one or two centuries, we have stepped up the speed of extraction. So right now, we have extracted the easy resources. Now we are starting having troubles because we have to access the difficult resources. Resources are expensive, and if it is expensive, it means that you have to allocate resources to pay for these resources, and that's having effects, bad effects on the economy. My impression, and not just mine, is that most of the problems that we see today in the world, economic problems, but also political problems, strategic problems, geopolitical problems, are due to the fact that resources everywhere are becoming scarce, in the sense that they are becoming expensive. And at this point, you have to fight for what is left.
I totally understand why people say, you know, if this is getting too expensive, maybe we won't go after it anymore. But as a scientist myself by training, let me flip that a bit, because what we're really saying is that the marginal utility of going and getting that next ingot of aluminum, say, is not worth the benefit we're going to get from that as a society. But aren't we really saying that the work required to get the work, not just human labor, but the total work of applying force over time, the work required to get the aluminum no longer justifies the benefit that we get as a society. And costs are just, as costs go up, that just sort of reflects the fact that more and more work is required.
You mean energy, I suppose.
Energy, yes, I want to get to energy.
The energy. Eventually, it's all a question of energy, because to extract minerals, you need energy. And that's the problem. You need more and more energy, and you have less and less, because energy comes from minerals, which are fossil fuels. You see the problem?
That's exactly the problem. And so, as I look at this, I'm seeing that I think you're absolutely right. We have to look at everything interconnected. What's happening in the Ukraine, Yemen, Libya?
Yemen.
What's happening in, or happened already in Egypt and continues to unfold. We could look at those as political events, but you might look at those and say these are resource events.
Very likely, yes. I think you can say that, actually. Actually, of course, it's an interpretation, but it makes sense. You can see a country like Yemen. You cited Yemen. It's a very interesting case. Yemen was an oil producer, not a small one. It produced an important amount of oil, and they went through a complete cycle of production. It went up to about 500,000 barrels per day, which is a substantial amount, and then it went down. And now, at this point, it is very close to produce just as much as it consumes, so it will not be able to export anything anymore. Why that? Well, if you look at the newspapers in Yemen, everybody says it is because of terrorism, it is because of Al-Qaeda, it is because of sabotage, it is because our politicians are thieves, it is because of evil conspiracy against us. But really, if you look at the data, the production curve of oil for Yemen goes through a very nice, very clear bell-shaped curve, which simply indicates depletion. Depletion in the sense that Yemen oil went through first through the easy resources, the oil which was close to the surface, which was easy to extract, and then slowly the investments needed to extract more oil became so high that nobody wanted to make these investments anymore. So eventually production started declining, and now you can see that Yemen is a disaster in political terms and social terms. It's a complete mess of tribes fighting each other, and that's, I think, you can explain in terms of simply people don't have any more money, don't have any more services, running out of food. Actually, you can read that even of gas in Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, you have problems because the service stations cannot provide any more gas for people who need to fill their tanks. So you see what can happen. But if you look at the data, actually, there's still some oil in Yemen that could theoretically be extracted, but at such high costs that it is not done and it will probably never be done.
Well, this is an important point then, which is this idea that when you get down to diminishing grades of ore or very small pools of oil left under the ground or whatever the marginal resource is, you need to do more and more and more simply to stay in place. Something in your book called the Red Queen Syndrome.
Yeah.
And just describe that for us, if you would.
Well, of course, I think everybody knows the story of the Red Queen, and that this strange place in of the book, Alice in Wonderland, where you have to run as fast as you can just to stay in the same place. And that's the point. I mean, if you want to keep extracting oil, you need to invest more and more resources. And that's the problem, because your resources are limited. You have to take them more than limited. You have to take the resources from something else that you could find useful in at level of a state. If you want to keep extracting oil and you have to pay more for it, it means you have to save on social services, social security, retirement funds, or whatever you have. And that's the problem, what we're seeing here. And there is no doubt that costs are increasing. I mean, the oil industry spent more than $600 billion in 2012 to prospect and develop new sources of oil, which is a lot of money. You know, it's one of those decisions that you wonder who decided that as a world, as a humankind, we should spend more than $600 billion in this specific purpose. You know, and the answer is that there is no organism, no body, no structure that decides this. It's a result of micro decisions taken at some level that somebody thinks that we will have a return from spending a lot of money into developing new oil sources, and so this money is spent because the financial system thinks that it is a good idea, so it allocates resources to developing new energy resources in the form of fossil fuels. But this is a choice. We could have reasoned in a different way. We could have invested that money in nuclear plants, for instance, or renewable energy plants. And you see all these kind of macro decisions, which eventually you see in the world, you read about that after these decisions have been taken. They are leading the world in some direction. But the problem is that spending so much money into developing new oil means that we have taken the road of diminishing returns. You see, what is the problem? I think this is a major mistake that we have made as a civilization. And it will be very difficult to redress it.
It sounds suspiciously like the decision the Romans made.
Yes, don't you think so?
Yes, they're diminishing their productive engine, of course, was their military, and that's how they went out and secured additional resources after they depleted their own soils or depleted the mines, and they used that same tool, their military, well past the time it made any sense, deep into diminishing returns, and
they spent a huge amount of money building fortifications around the borders of the empire, and that was a major loss of resources that eventually it kept the empire working for a little longer, but eventually spending too much destroyed them.
So when I see one of those gigantic offshore ultra deep water platforms, I ought to be thinking of it as a Roman fortification?
Could be. That's a good idea. It would be interesting to think in these terms. I mean, you have to think, as usual, as we said at the beginning, it's a question of energy. How much energy is that platform bringing in comparison with the energy and resources which have been needed to build it?
Yeah.
Now, I think we are close to be even in that. The ratio of the two energy getting close to one. And energy is a physical parameter, but not necessarily a financial parameter. From a financial viewpoint, you can still make money even losing energy. So that's another big problem we have, because people who take financial decisions don't know anything about energy.
Well, you know, mining has been going on for thousands of years, some people tell me, and they say, well, perhaps, you know, maybe there's thousands more years left. And as you mentioned in your book, the truth is you could take any piece of ordinary rock, and if you could decompose it all the way down, you'd find all kinds of elements in there. As I understand the data, in the last 34 years, just 34 years, half of all the copper ever mined in history has been mined. What I'd like you to do is help our listeners understand the mining process, because I think it's understanding what the process actually is. As you go from this ore, which looks like rock, which might have 0.2% copper in it, to that finished ingot. Can you walk us through those steps so that we can...
I could try. That interesting is how the mining process is today and what it should be in the future, what it will be probably, and what we could make it if we really were thinking how to make what I could call the sustainable mining, which is, I think, possible. I'm not pessimistic in this. I think we could do it. We can walk out of this situation if we really want to. So the point is that now we mine from sources which are extremely diluted in comparison to what was the standard 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago or so at the beginning. Think of gold, for instance. People would use panning, you know what is panning, finding nuggets in rivers, and that the grade of an ore is 100, of a nugget is 100%. A nugget of gold can be 100% gold or at least 100% precious metal. It normally contains a bit of silver, but that's gold anyway. You don't care so much. But then they had to move already from the time of the Romans. The beginning, they would find nuggets in the Alps. But then they had to move it to go to the mother lode, which means you have to dig out gold out of the mountains, which takes a lot more work. You have to use picks and hammers and all that, and then you go on. And there have been several cycles of mining. For instance, gold is a good example, but just copper is the same. You have to go using more and more energy to mine for lower and lower grade ores, which means that today you can mine gold from ores, but you can take this rock in your hands and you don't see any gold because it's so diluted that you don't see it by the naked eye. And so you have to use a lot of chemistry, which involves cyanides and mercury or whatever, to get this gold out, which is expensive. It can still be done. So there's a story, for instance, so the mines that the Romans exploited in what was at that time the region of Dacia, which today is Romania. And then today, I mean, there are talks about reopening the mines in Romania because now we have ways of extracting gold which make it possible even from extremely diluted deposits. It's possible. It may bring a profit, but it costs a lot of energy, and that's the big problem. And so, you see, I think we are approaching a point in which recycling will cost as much or less than mining, because so far we have not recycled so much. We recycled very little, because in general, mining costs less than recycling. There's nothing to do about that. Many times we do recycling because we think it's a good thing to do, but if you consider the costs involved, it's still less expensive to mine many materials than recycling them. Make you another example. For instance, you know about lithium batteries. Yep. Lithium batteries are the latest development, the best batteries we have now. And you may be interested to know that the lithium recycled from batteries is near 0%. Because lithium is still so cheap to mine that it makes little sense to recover it from old batteries, which is stupid if you think about that, because eventually you'll be in trouble. But as you mine more lithium is exhausted slowly, and then you have, at some point, you will have to mine lithium out of batteries, which will happen, absolutely. And then with all minerals, you have this slow transition from mining being cheap and recycling being expensive to a point in which mining becomes more and more expensive and recycling doesn't become so cheap, but it becomes not so much expensive than mining. At some point you can choose to do recycling. So I think it is possible to, at some point in the future, we will be able to move to an economy which recycles 100% of everything. It is not impossible. It is possible. Just think of land, plants, trees, for instance. I mean, you know, we have had trees on this planet for 300 million years. And trees use minerals. Trees are miners. They take mine minerals out of the ground. But in 300 million years, they didn't run out of anything, okay? So how can they do that? Because they recycle 100%. How can they recycle at 100%? First, because they use little. They are careful. And they use solar energy. So if you are careful, you use little, and you use solar energy, you can recycle anything at 100%. But it takes a certain way of doing it. You cannot do it so wastefully as we have been doing it so far, so up to now.
So it takes energy, and you know, one of the areas you mentioned before that I hear a lot of is people think that we could limit our use of fossil fuels by moving into, say, nuclear energy, by which I mean uranium as the nuclear source. Is that going to be possible?
I Personally, I think not. If you read my book, you will find some discussion about nuclear energy. And with nuclear energy, we have a big depletion problem, which cannot be ignored. May not be so bad as some people think, but it is there. Right now we have this big problem because uranium is a finite resource, just like fossil fuels, like oil, like gas, like coal, and all that. So in the case of nuclear power, it depends a lot on the kind of technology you use. If we remain within the present nuclear technology, the kind of reactors we use today, then there is no way that we can expand nuclear energy to a level such as it can replace oil and give us enough energy to do everything we really want to do and we need to do if we want to survive as a civilization. Then, of course, some people may have a point and say that we can develop better technology. It could be, and if we could develop much better technologies, then we might be able to extract, for instance, uranium from seawater. And that would give us a lot of uranium, maybe, but I'm a bit skeptical about that. But there is no, as always, when you discuss about technology, there are always new possibilities. So you cannot say with absolute certainty we don't have enough uranium, no matter what. But right now we are in trouble. That's sure, for a problem of mineral uranium availability. My opinion, renewable energy is a much safer bet because in that case we rely mainly on minerals which are abundant and cheap, like silicon for solar cells, which is the main component of solar cell is silicon. Then we need just traces of other minerals to make the contact. Then we need a bit of aluminum, which is also abundant to make the plant. Then we need the electronics, which needs some not just cheap minerals, but that's a general problem. Electronics is for nuclear, for fossil fuels, for renewables, is the same problem for everything. So I think renewable are a reasonable, safe bet on where to go to obtain abundant and cheap energy.
Let's talk about the scale of that. We could obtain abundant and cheap energy, but do you think we could do that at the scale we're currently using energy? I'm looking at a chart here which shows total world energy use, and fossil fuels are, give or take, about 80% of that mix right now.
Yeah, that's right. That's a big problem. I mean, I think we could. I don't think we will, because, you know, there's so strong resistance. So much is the tendency to stay with the business as usual that people are reluctant to invest now for a future gain. So right now, it is still a difficult proposition to say whether it is better to invest in fossil fuels or renewable energy, because the yields of renewable financial returns from renewable energy are very good, but over a longer time span. And as human beings, we have a tendency to discount the future, as you know. So we prefer normally a buck now than a buck in 10 years from now. So that's the reason why I think we are still investing so much money into fossil fuels, even though it is a dead-end road. So in principle, technologically, I think it's not impossible to, it's perfectly possible to make a system that produces a lot of energy from renewable sources, a lot. I mean, even much more than what we're doing now from fossil fuels, and to produce it for a long, long time. But it is expensive. We need to make sacrifices. We need to think long term, and we need to make big modifications in our society. Go ahead.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because information doesn't lead to behavior changes in humans. I was just at a conference recently where I was speaking, and Paul Ehrlich was there as well. And so, you know, he wrote Population Bomb, and the year before or 2 years before I was at the same conference,
and
Dennis Meadows was there. So Limits to Growth, both of these books proved rather handily, I think, that information is insufficient to lead to cultural decisions. In your view, what does lead to change?
That's a good point, a good question. We, as you say, we have plenty of information about the present crisis. It was predicted with reasonable accuracy back in 1972. We knew that we were facing a resource crisis. Absolutely. But we didn't do anything because I think we have such a good propaganda system that was developed during the mainly during the First and Second World War, which now works so well that it affects also the people who use it. So we get we convince ourselves, if we want to convince ourselves that resources are still abundant, that there is no such thing as climate change, if there is, it will not do us any harm or whatever. It's a system works, and even the people who theoretically manage it eventually get influenced by start believing in their own machine. So it's a big problem we have is that we have a system which really does not have the capability of doing long-term decisions. We work on or everything is on a short term, and we have big problems here because you see our system is still somewhat primitive, because to make a real efficient decision system we need to integrate various decision levels in society from the bottom to the top. And our system is extremely imperfect because the bottom can influence the top only every 4 years or so by those games we call elections. But really the top is not very much influenced by the bottom, and we would need a more integrated chain of decision making, but we don't know how to do that. The point is so efficient that some people right now are saying we want back a dictatorship, which I think it's a bad idea. It's worse. It's a solution which is worse than the problem, because when you have a dictatorship, then the top has no contact with the bottom, and it is worse. But really, we have this gigantic problem, and we don't know how to solve it. I think we have to put up with the consequences of this system, which is unable to take wise decisions. And so we will have to stand the hard times coming. But again, I think eventually there is a reality out there. So no matter how hard we can convince, how well we can convince ourselves that fossil fuels are abundant and they're perfect energy source, eventually we will be forced to stop using them. There's nothing to do about that. And if renewable energy, as I think, is so much better as it is, then we will use renewable energy. There is no alternative to using the right thing to use eventually. I think that you can make mistakes. If there is a road that will lead us away from this predicament in which we are now, I think eventually we will take it, but it will not be easy.
Well, it's interesting. You know, my work has led me, as a scientist, I love information, data, all that, but my work has led me to the conclusion that information is not helpful. If that information is being presented and it runs counter to the beliefs that happen to be entrenched, and we have a belief in growth. We talk about growth constantly at the political level, at the banking level. So the finance and the political systems are both entwined around this idea of growth.
Yep.
To me, the problem and the solution are the same thing. So if growth is our problem, then ending growth is our solution. That's really the only conclusion I can come to. Does your work take you any other directions?
No, it's correct. Already Jay Forrester, who was the inventor of what we call system dynamics, which in turn is at the basis of the study we titled The Limits to Growth, he said exactly the same thing. The problem is growth. Growth is a problem. It is not a solution, you see. They discovered this is a curious aspect with human beings, so that usually you understand what is the problem, the critical point of the system, but you act on it in the wrong way. It is so typical. It's growth, you know. People realize that growth is a problem, but then how do they react? Instead of slowing down growth, they try all what they can to speed up growth, and that they make the problem worse. Let me make you another example about depletion. Everybody understands that we have a depletion problem, right? So what do they say? We should drill more. but they don't understand that if you drill more, drill baby drill, as you know, sure. You drill more, you run out of it faster. So you worsen the problem. So if you have a depletion problem, you have to drill less. But it's exactly the opposite as what politicians, company chairman, and whoever you ask the question will say.
Well, so we have that there. And here's the interesting thing. In your book, it's just full of all these examples of where we're clearly in a depletion stage where I think the rational response to entering a stage of depletion is to ask the question, how are we going to get by with less of this stuff coming out of the ground, not how do we apply technology so we can still get more of it out of the ground?
Exactly. And so this is, you see, it's a big problem that comes with the communication system which we have, which is not adapted to ask these kind of questions. It's very difficult to use the media to pose these kind of questions. It's nearly impossible.
So let me turn to the hopeful part of this story. When you are interacting with students these days, are you seeing that they are maybe having a different view of how the world works and around growth and around limits than in times past?
What I say to my students normally say, you know, boys and girls, I think I should have to apologize because my generation has destroyed most of the resources that you could have used. But on the other hand, I tell them, if you were in our position, you would have done the same. So you have no right of moral indignation. It's a problem which has to do with human beings. So there is not much that you can do. Even students, I think they're starting to realize the problem. But really, it is very difficult for students to take a position because I can put myself in the position of somebody who is 20, 25, or 30 years old, and the situation for people of that age is very difficult, especially here in Europe. And in Italy, let me say nothing about Italy, but you see, if you realize that we are really running out of resources, we have to make big changes in our lifestyle, we have big problems even about survival, physical survival. I mean, I think there's no qualms in saying that we will have this problem. And so there are several possible responses. Well, I think some of these young people exaggerate. They move to the countryside. They start becoming peasants, cultivating potatoes and things like that, which I'm not sure is the right response. I think we have to keep, to stand and to try to work on the problem. And I don't think we have to abandon all what we have been doing up to now to move to a rural society. That would be a wrong decision. I think we have to try to strive for a society in which we still have energy, but where this energy is abundant. I like abundant energy. I think everybody likes abundant energy. It doesn't mean that we keep growing forever, but we can have energy from renewable sources. And then with this renewable energy, we can manage our remaining mineral resources to keep a certain level of prosperity. Certain level. Doesn't mean that we can grow, doesn't mean that we can waste, doesn't mean that we can keep increasing population and growing and things, but I think if we have just a minimum degree of wisdom, which maybe we have, we can make it.
And this is, I think, one of the main points that Limits to Growth put forward, which I read in your book, which was a great summary of it, which is that Limits to Growth wasn't a prediction, although it's turning into a prediction, but that Limits to Growth was simply saying, if we continue on our current course, here's some possible consequences. And so what I like about that is the idea that we always have choices. We can choose to do this or that. We chose to put $600 billion into more exploration for oil and energy. We chose to put trillions of dollars back into a banking system that's clearly too big and made some really poor decisions. We're making those sorts of choices. We're making choices around Ukraine that a military solution is increasingly the way we want to go. These choices now have consequences that are different in this world than they were in the world of when I was a boy or when my father was growing up, right? Because in that world, you had the resources necessary to correct your mistakes. You could Marshall Plan and rebuild Europe. I'm not as sure that after we make the next set of bad choices and we wreck some stuff,
eventually we run out of bad choices too. You're right.
Right, and you go into sort of the Dark Ages, right? The Romans pull out of Europe, and
we could be.
things have to replenish themselves naturally, which takes time.
And eventually, you know what Stevenson is reported to have said: sooner or later, everyone sits at a banquet of consequences. At some moment, you face the results of your choices.
And that's what this interview has been about. I want to thank you for your time. We've been talking with Ugo Bardi, author of Extracted, How the Quest for Mineral Wealth is Plundering the Planet. It's been a great discussion. Thank you so much, and I hope to have you on the show again sometime.